dude, what is going on? I feel like we have election drama, and every time I look at the news over your end, some ambassador has said something outrageous and everyone's excited or pissed off.
Yeah, it's the best. It's like a reality show where, like, you know, one of the losers goes and sits in like the confessional room and like talks shit about everybody else. It's like that, but with ambassadors on CNN. It's great. I've been watching it every day.
You know, I really don't like ambassadors. I think they're really sketchy, like in general.
Yeah. Well, obviously, that's why I want to be one.
Hey, so this is The Gender Not. I'm Naz.
I'm Dan. So glad you're all here to join us. We're going to talk about consent.
Wait, hang on a second. You would make a lousy ambassador. You would not be a good ambassador. I think you're too direct. The reason I don't like ambassadors is because they're all diplomatic and, like, you know, nice and, like, I don't know, like, they're hosty and stuff. And I don't like people like that.
Well, yes and no. I'd be great. I can totally tell people anything they want
to
hear.
No, don't say that. Don't say that. I don't like that. Anyway.
I'm not saying I will do it. I'm just saying if somebody wanted to give me like $300,000 a year and diplomatic immunity to do it, I could do it.
Yeah, I don't think you could. I think you'd be really like...
And that's $300,000 that the U.S. government knows about. You know what I mean? I'm not talking about all these back channel deals.
Yeah, but I still think you're too direct, which is a good thing. But anyway, so this week we are talking about consent. You had a chat with Ellen Fredericks, who has written a book about the topic.
Yeah, she wrote the book Good Sexual Citizenship, How to Create a (sexually) safer world. And it just came out a few weeks ago, and we had a really fun and interesting chat. She's incredibly well-educated on the subject and has a lot going on.
Yeah, so you guys started off talking about masculinity. I took that all out, not because it wasn't interesting, but because... there was just a lot you talked about. I'm just raising that because you kind of vaguely go back to white male genocide. I raise it because you kind of went back to it a bit. So that's kind of what you guys were talking about.
What is white male genocide, Naz? A guy can't talk about masculinity on his own podcast anymore.
Well, first of all, is this one of those like, you just can't say anything anymore? No one can say anything anymore.
White guys are getting, what do I even do anymore? I can't even compliment a woman.
You can't say anything anymore. You get these women of color coming in and ruling the roost.
Ugh, don't get me started on these Persian broads.
Speaking of which, before we play the tape, I saw a really funny cartoon going around this week, which I had to share. I sent it to you and you thought it was funny. So it's two stick figures. And it's like Bob and Sally. So it says, and they're holding hands, right? And one of them has like the Republican elephant and the other has the Democrat donkey. And it says, this is Bob. He voted Republican. This is Bob's friend, Sally. Sally voted Democrat. Bob wants to put many of Sally's friends into concentration camps. Bob is still friends with Sally because she's white. Sally is still friends with Bob because she's a coward, and challenging white supremacy makes her uncomfortable. I think this is so good. I feel like this applies to like so many scenarios of like woke people who, you know, like to be theoretically woke but aren't ever going to step up.
Yeah, they're never going to get rid of their high school friends. Yeah, I mean, unless you're related to the person, like, come on, do your job.
Cool. So anyway, this is Dan chatting to Ellen Fredericks about consent.
So I'm an educator, mm-hmm. and I think a lot of it is about talking to people young, long before they ever have sex, disrupting gendered assumptions in our own lives, modeling for kids, starting consent education as soon as a kid can talk. And that's not talking to a four-year-old about what sex is going to look like. That's talking to them about things like, does your friend want to hold your hand? Did you ask them? Did they really want to hug you right now? Not forcing kids to hug relatives, teaching them to respect their own bodily autonomy, and then showing them that they should respect other people's. I think that's stuff that if we start with kids early, that we could get really deep about this, and I talk about this more in my book, but bodily autonomy is even things for kids, like letting them choose what they eat, right? We are so used to telling children they don't have choices about their bodies that then they grow up and they think that other people have the right to make choices about their bodies for them. You say, you must finish this. You have to eat this. You can't wear this. You have to wear that. You have to hug this relative. So we're not giving them the flexibility and the space to make choices for themselves. And oftentimes, yeah, they're kids. They're going to just eat candy all day.
I still do that. And I am 36 years old.
So I guess, you know, I really just think that we need to start these conversations early. We need more comprehensive health education and sex education. Obviously, you know, that's my background. That's what I do. And so I believe in it. It's not perfect, but
dude, I went to Catholic school, right?
Oh, okay.
And I feel like I got better health and sex education at Catholic school.
Amazing.
Than most people.
If you're 36, you grew up under abstinence education, probably, right? That was a Clinton era thing. Not it was coming in. I mean, that was a real kind of Clinton, and then Bush, number one, really increased funding for it. So
I didn't go to public school, so we were just taught what the people thought was like good for kids to know, and like we were not taught like don't have sex with people. We were taught like sex educate, like we were given like health and safety stuff about it, and like we learned anatomy, and we learned like. Yeah. What reproductive organs do and like all that stuff. And I know people who are my age, and maybe it is because of this Clinton stuff.
Yeah.
I know people who are my age that don't like I don't know if I'm going to leave this on the show, but I was one time talking to a woman who was maybe a couple years younger than me. And I don't know how we got to this point in the conversation, but sometimes I have weird conversations with people, as you may have noticed. But she didn't realize that she peed out of a different hole.
Oh, you know, she's not unique in that. Years ago, I was teaching an HIV prevention program in the Bronx. There was a woman doing an English class, a grown up, and I literally walked out of my sex ed class with a bunch of middle schoolers, and she said, "Whew, teaching sex ed, that's a lot." And I said, "Yeah, you know, gosh, I can't even tell you how many kids think that girls pee out of their vaginas." And this English teacher said, "Well, don't we?" Right. So this is like, you know,
it's amazing. And that's when it clicked in my head. I was like, oh, wow. Somehow my Catholic school sex ed was better than public school.
Well, if you were not getting this government program, it sounds like it was, you know,
it was
hitting a lot of important bases.
Yeah, it was great.
I credit the Vancouver, British Columbia public school system with really good sex ed. We had this woman, Meg Hickling, who was a nurse who got the Governor General of Canada's award at some point, who came in starting in grade 5, as we called it then, not 5th grade.
I understand, yes.
Yeah.
I know a lot of Canadians. We got the CBC in Seattle.
Okay, right. So there you go. But in grade 5, I remember Meg Hickling, who's a nurse who's now, you know, won awards all over Canada for her amazing sex education. She was our sex ed teacher. And then in grade 8, which was already high school, we didn't have middle school or junior high, we had a nurse from the local clinic, the Pine Free Clinic, came into our 8th grade and in an assembly explained where the free clinic was and that you could get all these reproductive health services, you could get emergency contraception. This is, you know, the late 80s. That wasn't available morning after pill EC in America till 98, I think.
Yeah, I learned on Loveline.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I just feel that I grew up in an environment where there was access to healthcare, where I had grownups talking about this, where we, you know, the communication was really solid. It didn't spare me and my classmates from every horrible thing that could happen, but I think I came out of that system with a decent base of knowledge.
Mm.
So I'm a good, you know, I'm a believer in access to information, access to healthcare, dismantling gender stereotypes as we go. You know, you had mentioned something that made me think about this, but being somebody who intervenes, not normalizing hostile behavior. I think that's huge. You know, that be that person who says, you know, that joke's not really funny.
Right.
If we're talking about dismantling this pyramid, and it's uncomfortable and it's awkward. And I'm not the person who wants us to cancel everybody. And I'm not a huge call out culture person. But I think there are moments when we can point out that something's not cool by saying things like, "That's not cool."
Yeah, dude, you know? That's not cool.
That's not cool.
And you got to do it in a way that's like, that like lets them know you're still cool. That's the hard part. You know what I mean? Like you got to be like, if you're not cool, then nobody's going to trust you when you say something's not cool. Right. You know what I mean? They're going to be like this square, always being a square. But if you're cool and you like do cool things and you're like semi-influential around your circle of friends, then it is your responsibility to be doing stuff like this. Do you know what I mean? Like, obviously squares are going to be boring squares their whole lives and nobody wants to listen to them. But if you're like a righteous dude, then you need to be stepping up.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is not totally related, but there's this concept that I find fascinating. And it's this researcher, I think she's a sociologist, Dr. Sarah McClelland. And she came up with this concept of intimate justice. And I might be paraphrasing it or summarizing it and missing some major points, but I think it is just so fascinating when we think about sexuality. Her idea is people often say to others, folks, like, was that sex good? I mean, the word she uses in her academic papers is satisfactory.
Hmm.
Like, yeah, I'm having a good
time. Very academic.
Yeah, my sex life is satisfactory. But if you don't define what satisfactory means to that person, if you're a victim of sexual violence, maybe it just means that it was consensual.
Yeah.
Right? So what does satisfactory mean? And if you're asking people, like, how's your sex life? They're like, oh, it's great. Well, they might be thinking, you know, it's great because it's not forced. There's not accompanying violence. It doesn't physically hurt. Or they might be thinking it's great because they're, like, getting off 17 times and they're having mind-blowing orgasms. But if we start from this idea that everybody has the same definition of what good or normal or acceptable sex is, we're not really going to make headway because we're not coming from the same place.
Right.
And I think for a lot of women and, you know, maybe sexual and gender minorities of any gender, satisfactory sex is probably different for cis-hetero than it is for cis-hetero men on average. Not universally, but I think for a lot of men, asking if you had good sex means they had an orgasm.
Right.
I think. And for somebody else, that might not be what satisfactory sex is. So I think, you know, when we realize that even our language is sometimes not in step, and there aren't these universal truths, I think that's helpful in realizing, you know, what our limitations are and tackling some of these issues.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it goes back to that idea of, like, we're all individuals, right? And so, like, it's crazy how sometimes that's beneficial to a thing, and sometimes it's like it can completely destroy something, right? Like, when we all have to be fucking individual and make everything about ourselves, it destroys everything. But then when we try to think of everybody as, like, one way, right? Like, there's one response to things, there's one definition of good, then that destroys us. And so we have to, like, somehow live in the middle, right? We have to recognize individuality, but we also have to work our individuality into societal well-being.
So here is the analogy I gave to my sixth grade class today when I was trying to explain that, you know, sometimes we have to have common language, but we can all have our own perspectives. We want to be respectful. That, you know, you and I can both be standing on a beach looking at a beautiful tropical ocean. I might say that is the most beautiful green ocean. And a person, you know, and you might say that is the most beautiful blue ocean. What are you talking about? That ocean is blue. We might get in a stupid fight about what color the ocean is. And it's true for both of us. But what we're losing sight of is that we agree it's an ocean because we're so busy trying to prove that I'm right and you're wrong.
Yeah.
And that, I think, you know, when we remember that everybody has a different perspective and we all have our own personal views, I think there probably are some universal truths. I'm not really great at.
Well, yeah. One of those is that's an ocean.
Right.
That's a universal truth.
Right. But then around that, you have to understand where people are coming from before you try to, if you want to change their behavior, you have to look at what they actually think is or isn't true or acceptable.
Well, sure. And it comes back to that, like, unwillingness to, like, lose our individuality, right? Like, am I wrong? And then, like, it's weird how sometimes being wrong is the worst thing that could ever happen. Do you know what I mean?
Cool.
Like, and it does. And I have had there was that whole thing. I don't get into social media, but there was that whole thing of, like, that dress or whatever where people were like,
oh yeah, pure gold.
People were like, fuck you and fuck your dad and fuck your whole family, that dress is whatever color it was.
Gosh, I forgot about that.
And, like, people were mad at each other over the color and see that was the exact opposite, right? It's like, we are losing sight of the fact that this is a stupid $1 million dress that nobody cares, that isn't even a good looking dress, it's just some boring rich people dress. Yeah, but people get mad because there is no, like, for some reason, being wrong is just in, like, it's unfathomable, like, the wave of tension that creates in a human body the idea.
Yeah, I mean, it is so interesting that in a world where we really do celebrate individuals, we are so intent in having people agree with us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, that it doesn't completely line up when you're thinking about, you know, the way that we should be viewing things. But, you know, sports teams, like, I like the Yankees, you like the Red Sox. People can argue for days about that, or which is the best band. And
which is weird because we do that with no other profession. Do you know what I mean? Not really, but I mean, there are some people are I like Apple and I like Microsoft, whatever. I guess those are professions, but nobody's ever man, our fucking machine factory is better than the one in what, you know, nobody cares, but we care about sports. I don't get it. I'm a real loser. I don't understand sports. I grew up in Seattle. We didn't have sports in the 80s.
Mariners were the Mariners, right?
They were good for 2 years in the mid-90s.
I don't even know what they play. I think they play baseball.
They are the baseball.
Am I right?
They are the baseball.
Okay, so that's
right.
Right. Okay.
It's okay. A lot of Vancouver people really enjoy Seattle sports. I don't know why. Anyway. I get it. But it's, I get it because it's scary. It's scary to be wrong because if you're wrong, maybe you'll probably die alone, right? That's the weird logic ladder that everybody skips every rung between bottom and top is just, if I'm wrong, I'll die alone.
And I think also in at least, you know, modern American society, often being wrong can open you up to it's a really litigious environment we live in, right? So accepting blame, that can open you up to public scrutiny. It can open you up to legal action in some cases. You know, I've seen in a few of my online sex ed type of sexuality circles, not any that I'm personally involved in, but kind of peripherally, people have been doing accountability circles. Has this come up for you at all in your kind of work with this topic? It's an interesting concept, but it's basically if somebody in a community has harmed somebody else, usually sexually, but maybe otherwise, they then, and I'm not an expert in how this works, but they then get a group of people to hold them accountable or to help them do the work as a community of moving forward. So they don't have to be banished from the community, but so that they can be held accountable. And, you know, there's been more and more kind of work on accountability and how we can, instead of, I think it goes along with reparative justice, right? That if you harm somebody, instead of being locked up and taken away from society, can you repair the harm to that person? Schools are doing this. There's some alternative, you know, kind of sentencing programs who are offering an option of reparative justice. But this is what I've seen just kind of in some of these sex ed worlds. It's more individuals, communities kind of saying, this member harmed us in some way. Is there a way for them to remain in the community if they do the hard work? And we're going to hold you accountable. And it's an interesting model. I mean, I think it holds a lot of promise. Yeah.
Well, I think, it's this whole thing that we see all the time right now with famous people doing bad things, mostly to women, you know, with the apology, you know, and it's is an apology good enough, right? Or does there need to be work done? You know what I mean? The words I'm sorry don't usually mean anything unless there's an action behind them, in my opinion.
And I think I generally agree with that. I'm a huge person. I really like to hear I'm sorry.
Sure.
I'm constantly saying, can you just say you're sorry? You know, this is something that works for me. But I think on a larger scale, action really is important. I talk about a personal.
Well, I'm not trying to say don't do the I'm sorry. I'm just saying
agreeing with you. Yeah. No, I was just saying I talk about an anecdote in my book where I had, you know, a really unpleasant experience many years ago with somebody who then went on to really become an amazing, decent person in the world and reached out to me at some point to say, you know, I just wanted to get back in touch. And I know the last time we saw each other, we were in this really bad place. But let me tell you about where I've been in my life now. And they really seemed like they had kind of spent their adult life being a really good person. Mm-hmm. And that meant a lot to me. And I really felt like I didn't want to hold them as a bad person and hold a grudge. And I really love the idea that people can change. But I don't think you can just say you've changed. I think it actually does take some work that you have to demonstrate that.
Yeah. I mean, so I don't ever get into all the specifics of it. But I don't drink anymore for very good reason. And a big part of, you know, the method that I have pursued for that is, you know, righting a lot of past wrongs. And so, and that, like, that's a huge part of most, like, I don't know, I don't want to say like self-help, but well, like, you know, step-based programs. Sure. is this process of like going back and figuring out where in life, you know, especially in relation to the problem I'm solving, whether it's an addiction or a food thing or a sex thing or whatever, trying to go back and find where I was harming other people and then directly approaching those people and having a conversation with them where I take ownership for those things and I offer up a solution and ask, you know, whether or not they agree with that solution and if there's anything they'd like to add to it, and then, you know, go forward with like making that progress.
And if the person says, you know what, I just don't want to engage, how do you feel like you then respond to that?
I mean, that's 100% the right, like the goal isn't for me to like fix the situation, right? Necessarily. Right. I mean, obviously if there is a fixable situation, I would love to do it, but my goal is to like rid myself really of like the weight of this stuff, right? And the only way to do that, and the goal is to become a better person, right? And the only way to become a better person is to like actually face the things about myself that have like caused harm to other people, and the only way to really do that is to look them in the eye and talk to them about it and offer up a solution. And if that solution is go away, then that's the solution. Because and sometimes the solution is to just not even approach them in the first place, right? Because sometimes maybe I'm thinking of like a specific ex-girlfriend who I was just kind of a shithead to, but we had a pretty toxic and unhealthy relationship to begin with. And there wasn't anything where I was like, I wasn't like physically or verbally abusive, but I was just kind of a dickhead. And maybe she just never wants to see me again. And this was 10, 15 years ago. And like, it's probably best to just stay out of her life. You know,
right.
What I mean?
Is it more about you than healing her?
Right. Exactly.
Like asking that question. Right.
Right. And so, you know, and right. And so is it more, and then it becomes like, am I making this gesture to make myself feel better, or am I doing it to actually like repair right. damage? Right. Because right. if I'm trying to repair damage, I should just stay away from this person. She doesn't like me. You know what I mean? Right. And she's probably moved on and has a family and doesn't ever need to see me again. Whereas there's maybe a couple other people where like there was something a bit more severe and I need to actually like have a discussion with them, you know, and really like own up to my behavior. And it sounds like that's kind of what you're discussing with these like accountability groups where there's like people.
Yeah.
Around.
I mean, I'm just kind of a fly on the wall for this going on, but it's been interesting to watch just kind of peripherally, because I think it's a pretty new way of addressing this, but it's interesting because, you know, you mentioned recovery and 12-step groups have of course been doing this for years. And I wonder if the accountability circles have kind of drawn a little bit from that, but I don't know enough about it.
Possibly. I mean, it's, but that stuff is all drawn from like, old, like weird Christian stuff from the early 1900s.
Sure. I mean, that's probably a topic for a different show.
Yeah. The history of it is fun. But anyway, I was just saying that like I fully agree that like we like in order to, I don't know, because it's hard, it's this thing where I have to accept that I'm wrong, right? Which is, as we discussed, one of the harder things there is in life. And then I have to be willing, to do something about it.
Right.
Right. And then I have to actually like talk to people about it, because there's no way I can just change on my own. Do you know what I mean? Like if I knew how to change, I would have done it. You know what I mean? Like if I knew how to be the best version of who I am, I would have just, I wouldn't have been a dick in that situation. Oh. You know what I mean? So I have to like probably go talk to people. Like I, as a guy, would probably have to talk to somebody like you, or, you know, any like a therapist or something, and just go like, how do I change these things? And like, how do I start small and make it digestible and have an impact on myself so that I can have an impact on the world around me?
And I think more and more men are opening themselves up to the idea of therapy, and that's not brand new, but I do still think there is sometimes a message, you know, hold your emotions in, don't share them.
Oh,
that
God,
men
yeah.
get more than women.
Oh no. When you were talking earlier about like the things that we're raised with as men, like I had so many flashbacks.
Yeah, sorry.
No, it's fine. It's totally cool.
I mean, you know, you think about how little, like how young boys are when they hear the Boys Don't Cry. Like,
I was just
a big boy.
I was walking through an airport yesterday with my rolling suitcase, and I remembered that like we weren't allowed to have rolling luggage as boys because men carry things.
Oh my gosh. That was going on what, in the 80s and 90s for you?
Yeah.
That's wild because my dad, who grew up, he was born in 1947. He talks about how boys were not, nobody had a backpack when they carried books to school. They had a book strap,
mm-hmm.
and boys had to carry their books, their huge stack of school books under their arm, on their hip, and girls could carry them hugged to their chest. But
which is so much better for your lower back.
It's so much more comfortable, right? It's easier. You get two arms. It's more comfortable. Right. You get to balance
when you're using your core.
It was social suicide. It was not gendered. It wasn't acceptable. And that's fascinating that some kind of remnant of that still was encountering.
I would not own rolling luggage until probably like 5 years ago.
Were you allowed to have a backpack?
Yeah, I had a backpack. Okay. But when we were like going through the airport, like we had like luggage that we carried. Yeah, my stepmom had a rolling bag, but my brother, my father, and I had to carry anything that we were bringing.
That is
because men don't amazing. Because men and we weren't I this is actually what made me think of it. I was at an airport that had like a moving walkway thing that you stand on and it moves for you. And we were at the airport one time and there was one and my dad wouldn't let us use it because we had to walk the thing.
Wow. Yeah.
And that,
you can
like,
only imagine the kind of messages your dad himself had grown up with.
Right. And that's what I was saying about like, I have to live up to what my dad's wanted of my dad rather than what my dad wants of me. And like, it's cause it's this oh man, my grandfather, who I can't even imagine growing up under him, but like, And then here I am in this world where this stuff just isn't okay anymore. It's not okay for me to act like that. You know what I mean? And I'm not going to lie. Like in my 20s, if I was like going on a trip with a girlfriend or whatever, I'd be like, I'd be my dad in that situation. I don't do rolling luggage. I don't use the moving walkway. You know what I mean? Like, because it was just built into me and it's taken a lot of work.
So this is kind of explaining to me something. A man I knew very briefly, like playground encounters when my oldest daughter was a toddler baby and still in one of the baby carriers. I remember him saying, I'd never want to run one of those things. If I have to carry my son, I'm just going to carry him. I was thinking, what? You know, they make these devices so that you don't have to just carry your child everywhere.
Yeah. But then nobody would know how tough I am.
Yeah. And I kind of thought maybe he was joking, but he didn't seem like he was joking. He was never going to wear his baby. If he had to carry him, he'd carry him.
Yeah.
Similar luggage. Wonder how your dad felt about wearing children.
Oh, I don't think he would ever.
He wasn't a child wearer.
He would never have. No. God, Christ, no. My dad does everything the hard way. And I'm realizing how much of that has.
Oh, interesting.
Like just the past. You know, I've been kind of involved in this sort of thing for a few years now where, you know, and it's all happened by accident. You know, my buddy and I started a different podcast. It's just two straight cis white dudes trying to like understand things because so much was going on. We were just like, we should have guests on who have experiences that are different than ours and try to like just be better, I guess. And then that led to this show. And it's all just been kind of coincidence that I've found myself in a place where I've actually grown, which is neat. And I look back at this stuff from just a few years ago, like that suitcase behavior. And it's I don't know where I was going to go with this, but like I carried so much of that stuff for so long. And I still see it sometimes where it's just like, why do I have to do things the hard way? Amazing. I make myself do things the hard way. I do it all the time. I like 90% of what I do is done because it's the way you're supposed to do things. And it's like, well, shit, dude, it's 2019. You don't need to do anything the hard way anymore. Yeah. And I'm like breaking it down piece by piece. And it's,
you know, I think that actually impacts men in the ways you're describing. And it impacts women in slightly different ways. And I see it in the mothering communities.
Mm.
I see it in the make your own baby food, use cloth diapers. You're going to microwave dinner. Aren't you going to make that from scratch? Only use wooden toys. it's this weird gendered throwback under the guise of being a better parent. And I think that's way harder. All those things are way harder. And it comes from some kind of, you know, preconceived old-fashioned notion of parenting. And women who were making all their own baby food and nursing until children were two and, you know, using cloth diapers didn't have choices. And a lot of the choices that emerged allowed women to go out and work and have lives beyond taking care of their parents. But there is a real, taking care of their children, I'm sorry. There is a real, I think, movement to go back to a lot of that stuff that's often framed as, you know, being healthier and better and not seen as regressive. And I really bristle at some of that because I think we did things the hard way for a long, long time. And there's a good case to be made. It's 2019 for doing things the easy way. I think my children will benefit from me being a better rounded parent as opposed to me spending all day, you know, grinding my own flaxseed and making, I don't really know if you grind flaxseed, but that's not my style.
I don't know what you do with flaxseed. I know it's in the I know it's in the brand of granola that I buy that's already mixed.
And I don't want to criticize anybody's choices who prefers that, but I do think that it bears considering.
Cool. So that was Ellen Fredericks. Buy her book. I'm Naz.
I'm Dan. Our co-producers are Jonathan Blackwell and Sam Baker. Couldn't do it without them. Couldn't do it without you, Naz. Couldn't do it without you guys listening at home right now or in your cars. I don't know. I'm not going to assume where you are or that you're guys. You all. Let's correct that. Thanks for listening.